Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. A little bit of a cold today. I've been saying that for, 2 weeks now? It'll be over with sooner or later, and the guys who are with me today can't help me anyway with colds because they're not doctors, at least not medical doctors. They're doctors of housing and construction. Oh, man. Ken Adams of Adams Design and Build in Madison. Ken, great to have you back.
It's nice to be back, Larry. Good to see you, and I hope you feel better soon.
Oh, thank you. John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. John, great to see you.
Glad to be back again, Larry.
We'll give the number for you to join in. If you have a question, maybe there's something about your home that you'd like to have fixed or repaired, and you have a question about it, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. You know, in driving around the city, I have seen a lot of roofs with the ice damming going on, Ken, and some people up there trying to break those ice dams up.
Oh, there's a lot of that, and you have to be really careful because people like to go up and try to chip off some of the ice, and it could be very dangerous to go up, especially above the first floor, because ladders slip out from under you. This would be a time to hire somebody that is well insured and knows what they're doing to do that. Of course, the best thing is to figure out what's causing it, and then in the nicer weather, get somebody in there to fix it.
Yeah,
so it doesn't happen again.
And typically, is it an insulation issue that usually causes it? Or
it's insulation and ventilation.
Ventilation.
Yeah, you want to keep the heat in and the cold out, basically. And what's happening is the heat from the house is heating up the ice on the roof or the snow on the roof. It's melting, rolling down to the eave where there's nothing to heat it, forming ice again, and then water, melted snow above it starts to work its way under the shingles, and all kinds of horrible damage can occur. 2 years ago, I met this recently retired couple that every cabin in their kitchen was destroyed.
That's an
expensive
move.
It was all from ice damming. Oh, yeah. So it's really worth watching out for.
And we've got a question about oak flooring, I believe, coming up from Mary in Middleton. So let's go from the roof to the floors here and talk about oak flooring. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I listen to your guests regularly, and they are awesome.
Thank you.
Planning an addition to my, I have a home that was built around 1950. It's a little brick Cape Cod home, and it has hardwood floors throughout oak. I think it's red oak. And I'm wondering about the feasibility, not just cost effectiveness, but the availability of having used oak flooring in this addition. It's a space that'll be about 16 by 26.
Mm-hmm. That's, are you talking about finding oak that matches your original oak and, in both patina and age, that sort of thing,
yes.
Putting it in?
Yeah.
We do that quite a bit, and we know a lot of people that do that. The things to consider about that are when you look for old oak, a lot of times the refinishing process, you get buildup of finish in between the tongue and groove, so that has to be cleaned out. That's not too bad in and of itself, except that sometimes the old floors had lead in the finishes, so you'll want to test it for lead, and if there is, it's still okay to do, but you need to do proper lead precaution. Mm-hmm. But it's done all the time, and done pretty regularly, and I think it should be just fine. The main thing is try to match up the forestry, because trees that grow in oak that grows in Tennessee is different than oak that grows in Wisconsin. It looks different.
But it's easy enough to find. There's availability of it.
Well, I don't know where you're located, Mary, but
Middleton.
Oh, in Middleton? Middleton. Yeah, there are places all around. I know of a couple. You could check with Restore, which is part of the
Habitat
for Humanity. They sometimes get materials in. There's a place called Deconstruction. They take stuff out of old homes and buildings, and they might be a resource. You can call some hardwood flooring contractors. I know several. If you want to shoot me an email, I'd be happy to talk to you in a little more detail. My email, by the way, is ken@adamsofmadison.com. Adams spelled like the president, not the family.
Perfect.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Scott and Eau Claire, we're on to you. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a back to a roofing question. I'm going to put a metal roof on, and I have what I call a shed roof. So let me hopefully describe it. It's 12-inch rafters that I have only 10 inches of fiberglass insulation in, and on top of that, I have continuous soffit vent. In other words, I have a flat roof. You know, it's pitched appropriately. And I thought I read somewhere that when I put the metal roof on, I would be prudent in putting, you know, the, I believe it's pink, it's that real tight closed cell, 1-2-inch stuff under the metal. Now, I understand that I'm going to have the ventilation running from the soffit on top of my fiberglass, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe that's not a good idea, so I thought I'd ask the expert.
All right, John Freiberger, what do you think?
Well, Scott, it sounds like you're going to have an airway sandwiched by insulation on either side, which would make that upper insulation is going to really, really reduce its value.
Okay, so in other words, cost-wise, stupid.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make. I don't think it's going to make a lot of sense.
Okay, good. That's my answer. So my next question is: Would I be prudent in hiring a contractor to try to put closed foam on top of that 10 inches of fiberglass, or is that also, in terms of cost and efficiency, just really a fool's errand?
Well, you can certainly do it. You can take off the roof sheathing, and if you wanted, you could take off the roof sheathing. You could simply top up the fiberglass with high-density cellulose, and then you could put Cornell panels right over the top of it. You could order 1-inch or 2-inch or even 3-inch foam, so you'd have a full interstitial space between your rafters, and then you would have the Cornell panels with a urethane or an isofoam, and the Cornell panels come with the roof sheathing, and you can order them either vented or unvented. If it's a dark metal roof, you might want to order it with the vented, so it comes with an airspace. The Cornell panels are made here in Wisconsin, and they do have a website. In fact, we've just got done installing them on a house in Madison that had only 8-inch rafters, and to upgrade it to modern insulation levels, we just put on 6-inch thick Cornell panels.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying take the whole decking off the roof.
Right, take it all off. Go ahead and fill the interstitial cavity.
Right.
Right up to the top of the rafters, and then put the Cornell panels over the top of that.
Okay.
Now, you're not going to have any ventilation at all now. So it's going to be very important that you've got a good vapor barrier down on the warm side. And that can, of course, be done with a vapor barrier paint.
Well, what I've got, well, I've got tongue and groove ceilings. I do the fiberglass that's in there is got the craft paper on it.
Okay, that's going to help. And the thing is, with all the insulation we're going to have in there, especially with the Cornell panels up on top, we're just going to have such minimal air movement, and everything is going to be so warm that we probably are not going to worry about the condensation.
You just answered my question. That's what I wanted to find out, because I realize any living space, you've got water, but if I've got this again, flat rafter roof, then if it's filled appropriately, I don't have to be so worried about the moisture exchange.
That is correct, because the Cornell panels are going to get rid of the thermal bridging that you're going to have through your rafters. So your rafters are going to be much warmer now, and they are not going to be condensing out on the side, because usually your rafters are your second condensing surface after your sheathing. But your sheathing is going to be too warm to condense and too well sealed, so you're really going to have almost nothing to condense against, and you're going to have nice warm temperatures all the way up to the bottom of the foam insulation.
There you go. Thanks a lot.
One last, please. The Cornell panels, are they really expensive?
No.
If they're really expensive, I wouldn't be using them.
they're very cost-effective, aren't
yeah,
they?
They're very yeah. cost-effective. Cornell is the one I'm most familiar with, and I like it, of course, because it's made in Wisconsin. And Mike is always really happy. I've told him he's got to make a big donation to public radio this year. But there are other companies out there that make the same thing, so
are
it's always good
Cornell,
to get...
Are they made in Cornell, Wisconsin?
Yes, I believe they are.
Well, mm-hmm. I'll have to go up there. And I'm sorry, it was Ken at Adams what?
Well, that was my website, Ken at adamsofmadison.com. John's, what's your email address?
I am FREI at chorus.net. Chorus like a group of singers, CHORUS. And always happy to answer questions from any listener.
Me too.
Thanks so much, gentlemen.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Pat in Cottage Grove, on to you. Hi, Pat.
Good morning.
Morning.
We are also going to be putting a metal roof on our house. It has a 312 pitch. And we've had leakage and water damage, so we're going to a metal roof with metal panels. I just wanted to know what disadvantages there were. I realize it's more expensive, but is it noisy, or are there any other things that we should be aware of?
You have to make sure you have a real good quality standing seam roof with all hidden fasteners, because you can still get ice damming and leaking through a metal roof unless it is really a good quality metal roof. So make sure that you really take a look at the details and that you're working with a very good roofer.
Yeah. And there's a direct correlation between quality and price in this circumstance?
There certainly is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are some very inexpensive metal roofs, and we can guarantee that they will leak when they're ice dammed.
Another thing that could happen, and I have a metal roof on my shop, is that you'll get snow build up on the roof, and then all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, a huge amount of it will come sliding off the roof, usually right when I'm walking in the door. So that could be a downside, too.
Is it noisy?
No, it's
like
not noisy.
Like when it rains, or?
Well, you know, it's a little bit, it's a little different sound, but it usually isn't, see, everybody's
it's a different sound. It's not a noisier sound.
It's not, it could be very pleasant, you know, and except for in a heavy rain, light rain.
Judith, our NR producer, they have metal roofs.
She's
and
given
she
us
likes
the thumbs
it.
Up.
She likes
yeah.
it.
And,
yeah.
and Pat, be sure to check the thickness of the finish. Find out what its hail resistance is. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to end up with some very thin metal with without a good coating on it. The Kynar coatings tend to be some of the best coatings out there. So get all of your details, make sure you have your warranty information, and use a very good quality roofer whose references you have checked.
Yes.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at home renovation and repair today with Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. Questions for these guys, give them a call. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking home renovation and repair with John Freiberger and Ken Adams. Guys, we have an email from someone in Stoughton. It says we're updating our kitchen and with new appliances and countertops. The current configuration works well. We want a more updated look. We're looking at resurfacing our cabinets or replacing them completely. How well do resurfaced cabinets wear? Any drawbacks to resurfacing? Resurfacing costs about 40% less than replacing the cabinets with new ones. Any opinions?
Well,
Ken?
I've got a little bit of experience with resurfacing, and they can last quite a while. It's all in the quality of the
original.
Well, yeah, that's a good portion of it is the quality of the original cabinet, how well the veneers are glued on, because they glue veneers onto the framework of the cabinets. And then usually they replace the doors. Mm-hmm. So essentially you're using the existing cabinet box with a veneer over the top and then new cabinet doors. If you like the configuration and you could save some money, make sure that the person that does it for you has a good history of recommendations and has done this for quite a while. Other than that, I think that's a good bet for somebody that likes the configuration of your cabinetry and doesn't want to spend the money for new cabinets.
Absolutely. Mark in Green Bay emailed, I'm planning to insulate and finish the interior surfaces of my garage's exterior walls. Currently, they consist of 2x4 studs, half-inch OSB sheathing, and vinyl siding. Is a vapor barrier recommended, or do I want the walls to be permeable to the inevitable moisture from slush, etc., during the winter months? I may consider occasional heating in the garage with a future wood burner.
Generally, a vapor barrier is not going to be required in a garage, but make sure that your vinyl siding has a water barrier underneath it, because water will go right through vinyl siding. It's a rain screen, not a barrier. So if you have currently just OSB board with siding over it, that is where your moisture issue is.
Okay.
And that siding would need to come off and have a house wrap, a breathable house wrap put on it.
And when an email from Nancy, we have an older home built in 1954 on cement block. The house has two different overhangs of a couple feet wide and less than a foot from the ground. One overhang is a long closet. The other is over our kitchen and dining room areas. We have vinyl siding on those areas, but the wood floor has never been insulated and it is cold. How do we go about insulating those areas since it's so close to the ground? And what kind of insulation would they use?
Well, that's kind of a trick. What you're talking about is it sounds like your parts of the room is cantilevered out over the existing foundation, which is made out of cement block. You've got hardwood floors. The best way to do it is from the outside. Did she say she has vinyl siding?
Yes.
If she has vinyl siding, you could take the vinyl siding off. You can see if you can get into the cavities inside of the ring joist.
Mm-hmm.
If the joists go you should be able to get in there. So you might be able to do it from the side. You might have to remove the bottom, which means working in a very tight situation, or maybe even digging out a little bit of the ground to be able to get in there. So the best thing you can do, you could use two-part polyurethane closed-cell foam, or you could use a dense-pack cellulose insulation. And either one of those would probably serve you really well, especially what I think you're probably looking for is a minimum of about an R35. I think code reads 27, but that's too small. I'm not sure what the latest code is. I think they updated it. But try to get as much insulation in there as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's vinyl siding, you could put it all back on and it shouldn't cause any damage.
All right. There we go. Let's go to Nick in New Berlin. Nick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have wanted to go back to the ice damming thing. I think I have a special situation.
Okay.
Our living room has a massive fieldstone fireplace. And when we moved in, it was just bitterly cold in the living room, you know, because of the downdrafts coming off of that uninsulated fireplace. So my solution was to install a fireplace insert, and we burn fires almost all the time to keep the living room warmer and the fieldstone warm. Mm-hmm. But I think that's now transferring heat into my attic and causing an ice damming problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm wondering about, A, insulating the fireplace so I don't lose so much heat, either in the attic or on the outside or both. Any ideas?
Well, one that comes to my mind is if it's a fieldstone fireplace, is it cement block underneath or is it brick underneath? Is it an old-fashioned fieldstone fireplace with no substructure? Like, if you go in the attic, what do you see?
Fieldstone.
Oh, really?
In the attic.
In the attic. That's very rare.
How old is your house, Nick?
Yeah.
20 years old.
Wow.
Okay. There just has to be concrete masonry units underneath it. I can't...
I have not seen
a real fieldstone fireplace built after about 1880. Here's a couple of the issues, Nick. You have to have a space between any combustible and that masonry. So insulation cannot be applied to it. It could be applied around it. Basically, you'd have to build an insulation box in the attic around it and then insulate that box. Now, that box could then be vented. If this is against an outside wall, you could put a vent through the wall, low in the box, and with a ridge vent on the top so that cold air would be drawn in near the attic floor and would travel up, removing any air out of that insulated area and take it out through the roof. And then this little wall, insulated wall system that you built around it would keep that heat from propagating into the rest of the attic. But you're going to have to be very sure that you have good clearance away from this fireplace, because we don't know how warm that gets. This is one of these things where you want to be a little careful about prescribing something on the air without actually seeing it.
Have you had any fireplace technicians look at it, chimney sweeps, that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, I get it swept, but...
Do they install? Does your sweep install fireplaces, or is he just a cleaner?
I believe they're just cleaners.
You may want to have somebody that installs masonry fireplaces look at it, because this is new for John and I to see a late 20th century home with fieldstone all the way up through the attic. So... have somebody take a look at it. They could give you some pretty good advice. Otherwise, I think John's right on the money.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you, Nick, for calling. And let's go to Chuck in Prairie du Sac next. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning.
What can we do for you?
We're updating our bathroom, but we got a 1973 cast iron avocado tub that we don't want to tear out. Do you know anything about the liners that they sell as a replacement? Are they worth the money, or is that better just to leave the avocado tub in there alone?
Yeah, I don't know much about the liners. I've talked to a couple of people that said that they've had liners installed in their bathtubs and had good success, but limited life. One customer said that mold had worked its way behind the liner, too, and that could always be an issue. I don't want to diss the product because I don't know it that well, but you would probably be, I think, better off for the long term by installing a new tub.
Right.
That's what
I kind of thought, but I didn't want to go through the expense yet of
tearing it out.
Out to get to it.
Well, that's just okay. part of the gig. Good luck to you.
Thanks for calling, Chuck. And email from Gina. I'm adding a bathroom on the main floor of my home. There's a floor above the one we are adding the bathroom to. What would be the best way to ventilate the bathroom without having to go all the way through the attic? So
you're putting, she's putting a room on top of a bathroom, and she wants to ventilate that first floor.
She's adding a bathroom on the main floor of her home.
Oh.
So she's adding a bathroom. There's a floor above the one we're adding the bathroom to. So she's got...
Well, she could go out the wall with the ventilation.
Oh, I would think so. Yeah, she should be able to follow the second floor...
The joy space.
Joy space, and go out to the side. And the shorter the run you have for a bathroom exhaust fan, the better in any case. And that may be better than going all the way through the second floor, through the attic, out through the roof. The other nice thing is you can... You don't have all the problems with condensation that you have when you go through a cold attic.
Plus, anytime you put a hole in the roof, it's a hole in the roof. That's the weak link.
So run it out the side. Let's go to Carol and Nina. Hi, Carol.
Hi. My question is about plumbing fixtures. Our house is about 25 years old, and when we bought it, we fell in love with these gold faucets and drains and everything. And we were told, you know, to clean it, just use a Kleenex and no abrasives or anything. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'll just clean it less often. Anyway, 20 years later, all of these look terrible. They're terribly discolored, you know, you can't clean them. They just look awful.
Yeah.
Is our only recourse to pull them out and have them replaced, or is there a way of refinishing or cleaning them that you know of?
There's no cost-effective way of refinishing them. If the finish is wearing off, which is probably likely, then your best bet is to replace the entire fixture.
Yeah, that's what I kind of thought.
And this time, if you pick, you probably, when you say gold, you're probably talking about a bright brass with maybe a finish on the brass, so it keeps it really, really nice and shiny.
Yeah, it's not real gold. Yeah, no. I know that, but I don't know how else to describe it. But
yeah,
like,
so it's
you
that's that really nice golden.
Off or anything.
Yeah, it's in that, yeah, and it's very difficult to keep those clean. So if you're going to buy that kind of fixture, make sure you go to one of the big names like Kohler, Delta's high end, Moen's high end, American Standard.
No, I never want anything like it again.
Uh-huh.
What do you ask for? A stainless steel, is that the thing? Or?
Well, brushed stainless is fine. A good quality chrome. It really all depends on the manufacturer. I've got a 1920s home, and I've got the original bathtub fixture in it. Chicago faucets
last forever.
And they'll last. I've had them repacked once since I've lived there in the last 20 years, and they still work as good as they did the day that they were installed.
Chicago.
So you get a good quality. Chicago's one company. Kohler is a Wisconsin company.
Yeah.
Great company. Very committed to the area too. So it's a. I think it's a nice place to spend your money. Good. You know, good quality fixtures are really, really worth the. The effort.
Yeah, that's what we found out.
and they're not necessarily cheap.
Yes.
But they don't have to break the bank either. I mean, unless you stainless steel, brushed stainless is expensive. But if you get if you go with chrome or you know, say a brushed nickel finish, you save a little bit of money.
There you go. Thanks, Carol. Greg in Plymouth, we're on to you now. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I've got a 40x60 pole building. And I'm looking to insulate it, the walls and the ceiling. Before I went too far, I wanted to get your opinion on it. I have a porous slab, a concrete slab. It has heat tubes in it. And my idea was to run metal siding on the inside and fill the cavity with cellulose and have the ceiling sprayed with polyurethane foam, maybe 2 inches thick.
Uh-huh.
I took some of the frost pack insulations, and I was going to kind of seal the overlap of the metal. Would I still need to run like a poly over the top of that?
What do you think, John?
Metal siding on the outside of the building, you know.
And this is the usual, just lightly overlapped vertical metal siding on the exterior, typical pole barn siding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, typical, you know, farmhouse.
Yeah,
pole
and this is a slab on grade.
Yes.
Okay, so it's not a true pole barn. It's actually a...
Well, I'm sorry, I should correct. It had a dirt floor, and we put a slab inside.
Okay, so what we do have is we do have timbers, treated timbers going down into the soil is how the structure is put together. And
correct.
Then you've poured the slab, and you've got a nice thermal break around the slab, right?
Polyplastic, heavy poly, and a 2-inch foam.
Great, good, because then you've got that barrier. There's a couple of questions, and first is the question is whether we can get any water entry through that vertical siding, wind-driven
mm-hmm.
water. And if we can, and if we've got cellulose in the wall, then we're going to end up with really a bit of a mess, and we're
sure.
going to end up with corrosion. So again, this is one of these, like our Fieldstone fireplace, where we got to be a little bit careful what we say in the air because we haven't seen it.
Yeah.
You may be best off... since you're going to have somebody spraying the ceiling already, which is a good idea,
mm-hmm.
is if it will stick, which, and it may not, is if you can spray the walls, you
mm-hmm.
may try to spray the walls. The problem with foam is that it has to bond to something, and it won't necessarily bond to the metal. So
okay.
you, if you stud it out, you may be able to picture frame the studs and then spray across, and then it'll bond. But you're going to have to talk to somebody who really knows their urethane foam and knows
sure.
what they're doing with it. But I think you need some sort of exterior air barrier on anything, exterior air and water barrier, because they're really the same thing. Because I'm worried about wind-driven water coming into a wall and then wetting cellulose and then having a mess.
The foam seems to adhere to the metal because I sprayed like the overlaps with one of those frost
mm-hmm.
packs. And it really seemed to adhere very well, but you think I should go and have them spray like a half inch over the whole piece of steel?
I think that's going to buy you a lot because,
okay.
for one thing, is you're going to stop your air intrusion, and your air intrusion
mm-hmm.
is not only going to bring water in, but it's going to bring cold in. So
sure.
it's going to make your cellulose perform much better. And we've done this very frequently on old houses. We've actually sprayed an inch or two on the attic floor and then filled it up with cellulose because we didn't want to spend that much money on foam.
Yeah.
So this sort of two-part solution to walls and ceilings does work. But just make sure that you've run a good test on it. And remember that foam does shrink. And so you've got to have a contractor who really knows what they're doing and has had a lot of experience with this.
That's what kind of scared me, because all the contractors I've had look at it were all happy about doing it, except for one. He shied away from spraying the ceiling because he said if any of those nails that were pounded in were to leak, I would rust the roof from the bottom, from the top side of the foam. I would, you know, the roof would rust right off.
Yeah.
Well, you can indeed have that problem because it cannot dry to the bottom, though it can dry to the top. But if it's a metal roof, your fasteners should have little waterproof gaskets around them.
Yes.
And you may have to, you know, I go up and I inspect my roofs annually, and I'm constantly pulling them out and putting new gaskets down. I'm usually setting the gaskets in silicone to boot. So there's always maintenance to do on a...
Yeah, and you have similar kinds of buildings.
Similar kinds of buildings on my farm, yes.
Yeah.
So I've got a very big, I've got lots of metal roof out there, Larry.
How thick would you go on the ceiling foam? I'm not looking to heat it very warm, just the occasional work in the shop.
Well, you're looking at about our 6.3 per inch, so you're going to do pretty well. I think your 2 inches is probably going to work fairly well.
Okay, mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for calling. D emailed us and says, I'm having my cabinets replaced, also getting new silestone counters. Should I have the counters replaced before the cabinets are done? Ken, what do you think?
Well, she wouldn't be able to replace the lower cabinets first. She wouldn't be able to replace the countertop and then replace the lower cabinets. So the lower cabinets absolutely have to go in first. Typically, the uppers will go in at the same time. The only time that she couldn't really she could reverse it and put the countertops in first is if there's an upper cabinet that rests on the countertop. That'd be the only time. So the order of business is take out the old cabinets, put the new base cabinets in, have the Silestone installer measure and do their template for the countertops. Then the installer could go and put the upper cabinets in while the Silestone people are dealing with fabricating that, and then they'll come back in, put it in, plumber finishes it up, and then you have dinner.
All right. And by the way, several people have emailed in to say they all like their metal roofs. So, and Judith says she would confirm the snow coming down suddenly. It always scared their cat. Oh, let's go to Merv in Fish Creek. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry, and the rest of you guys. I got what I hope is a simple question, with a simple answer. My house is heated with a combination of electric baseboard, a couple gas fireplaces, some of the baseboard in some very seldom used rooms. I have the thermostat right on the electric baseboard heater. But I've got another kitchen and a dining room that I can't keep a thermostat working. All it is 2 8-foot garden variety 220 baseboard heaters, and I'm on my third thermostat and need to get a fourth one, a wall thermostat, and I've been to 2 different electricians. What do you think's the problem?
I expect that the thermostats are probably fairly inexpensive ones, and they're just failing due to being heated a lot because they're on the unit itself. And I think
he's saying wall mounted unit. Was it a wall mounted unit?
Well, he had one wall mounted, and the rest were on the baseboard, is the way I understood. Is that right, Merv?
No, some of them, a couple of the heaters are on the, and I don't have any problem with them, but they're not the ones that are used very often.
Right, but the ones that are used, do they have the thermostat right on the baseboard?
The ones that I'm, the thermostats that are failing is the wall thermostat that controls 2 8-footers.
Well, there could be an incompatibility between the thermostats that your electrician's installing and the baseboard heaters. So you'll want to check the manufacturer's recommendations on a wall-mounted unit and follow them. You also may want to talk to a heating contractor instead of an electrician that has some experience with this sort of thing, because he might be able to, or she might be able to, find a better match for you.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I never thought of that. See, that's why you guys are invaluable.
How's the weather in Fish Creek?
I really trust the electricians I've used, but I'm trying to heat.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to hook up a light bulb. So thanks for the good advice.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. All right, we've got Tim in Mequon who has a question for you. Hi, Tim.
Yes, good morning. We have part of our main floor is in 3/4-inch red oak, and it's laid over plywood substrate, and then the rest of the main floor is carpeted, and it's over OSB. And we've been thinking about extending the oak flooring throughout the main floor. And so far, we've got three real competent bids to do the work. But one of the contractors said that they don't necessarily recommend putting the hardwood flooring over the OSB. What would have to? There's two layers of OSB. They're both 5/8-inch, and the first layer would have to come off,
right,
so that the old flooring would match up. But I just wanted to know what you would think. Well, the guy that raised this issue said that he thought it would work. They just formally and officially don't recommend it, but he thought it would be okay. And that's caused me to be concerned a bit with going ahead with the project.
Well, you're going to put a lot of money into this floor. And the experience that I have is that the nails for the floor do not hold as well in OSB as they hold in plywood. And so I'm with your last contractor, the one that says you'd be in better position to replace. The top layer is probably enough. A layer of 5/8 plywood is ample to be underneath a layer of 3/4-inch tongue and groove flooring. So I'm with him. I'd say you're going to put a lot of money out, put a little bit more money out, and do it so that you know you could be confident in the finished product for years to come.
So you're saying that there's two 5/8-inch OSB layers. So you're saying take both of them out?
No, you could probably get away if you can, depending on how they were fastened. If you can take just the top layer off and put a new top layer of plywood on, that would probably be plenty adequate.
No, I don't think I can do that. In order to match up, one of these two layers, 5/8-inch layer, has to come off.
Oh, I see. So you have to take the top layer off to lay your flooring.
And he said, well, then, you know, there'd be the initial sub flooring, if you will, 5/8
sure.
left. And he said, well, even though they don't recommend it, they thought it could be done, and they would make sure that nails got driven into the joists below.
Well, that would be if he can guarantee that he can get the nails into the joists below, you're going to, that would probably be fine. You're going to alleviate your problem. But if there's any question at all, I would say if you can replace the plywood underneath or replace the OSB with plywood, you'd be in better position.
Yeah. That's a lot of work.
I know.
It's a lot of work.
It depends on how much you want to spend.
Yeah. There you go, Tim. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Mike in Madison, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I've got a ranch house built in the 70s that has perennial ice dam questions or concerns. It faces north, and it's got a pitch of, I think, 1/4 or less. And I'm just wondering what the best insulation method is to alleviate this situation so I don't worry about it year to year.
Well, one of the questions is, does this have a truss roof on it, Mike?
It does not.
It's a cut roof. Okay. Yeah. So it's a cut roof, so it really doesn't have an energy heel. So what's happening when we get down near that outside wall is our rafters have, you probably have maybe a 2x6 rafter, so we only have space probably for about 3 inches of insulation there, and that's really difficult to deal with. The only way you can get anything effective in there is to use a spray polyurethane. And even then, you're only going to be at about R18, R19, less than half of what you really want.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we have done on some houses is we've actually designed, where we don't have an energy heel, is we've designed a shaped insulation. And what we've done, because the insulation is waterproof, is we've shaped the insulation so if there is ice damming in that area, we keep open the 1-inch vent space, and if water comes through the roof, it actually drains down over the top of the insulation and drains out through the soffit.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is one of these things you're probably going to have to talk to a good insulation contractor to see, you'll talk to somebody who's done this before and knows how to work with houses that really lack an energy heel at the outside wall. And your venting there is going to be very, very important. So we've got to make sure you've got good airflow up through the soffits to clear the heat out in this area. And then the rest of your attic, you should probably get it up to, I would say, R50. Wouldn't you agree at this point, Ken?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right on the money.
So because we really want to limit the heat that's going into that attic and make sure we've got very good venting.
Right. The guy who built it didn't understand that concept.
Nobody did in the 70s.
No, that was a different world back then.
Yeah.
And the code, you know, the code was just upgraded now again a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because even the code we've been dealing with, the energy code is found to be inadequate into the 21st century.
Yeah.
I believe it's 2x6 is because of 5.5-inch.
Right. That's usually typical. And I think that's probably the most cost-effective way of going at it.
Well, I've been working at it, and so I've got proffer vents attached to the underside of the roof. And then what I've tried to do is push additional fiberglass insulation up next to it so that I've got the airflow.
What happens when you push fiberglass insulation into the cavity is it compresses and then it loses its insulation value.
All right, so
that's not really an answer. The proper vents are good. That's
right.
That's a good answer. Cavity. You want to do every cavity.
All right, so I do every cavity, and then instead of putting fiberglass insulation on top of the rafters.
On top of the wall, you mean?
On top of the wall.
Mm-hmm. As John said, foam.
Yeah,
foam insulation.
Urethane foam from that outer edge into a point where you can get R50 with either blown-in fiberglass, mineral wool, or cellulose. And I think both Ken and I at this point have more faith in high-density cellulose than anything else.
It's cheap and it's green.
Yes.
Well, what I've put on there is a couple layers of rolled insulation crisscrossing so that if I need to get down to the roof, I can roll it back and get at it. But I've got quite a bit up there. I think I've got about 18 inches on top of the existing rafters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think I'm close to that. It just okay. So you're talking about a spray foam,
right?
Yep. All right.
It's like great stuff in 55-gallon drums. Be installed by a professional.
Yep.
All right.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison and John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking home maintenance and renovation and repair today with our two guests, Ken Adams and John Freiberger. Email from Mike says, I'm replacing hail-damaged vinyl siding and would like a recommendation. I have a 23-year-old standard construction 4x4 walls with fiberglass insulation. Does it make sense to add insulation to the walls? I'm considering steel siding with the addition of foam boards, R7, or foam-backed vinyl siding, R4. You have a preference on those?
Pretty strong preference. Adding the foam to the exterior of the house and a good wind and water barrier over that is certainly the way to go. The vinyl siding with the foam in back of it is very, very inefficient. It really doesn't do much at all because you need a continuous barrier. And if you apply the foam to the exterior, that gives you a nice continuous barrier. Make sure you look very carefully at the detailing around your windows. You're going to have the exterior jambs extended. Those are all going to have to be air sealed. And the easiest way to do that, it would be to put a layer of commercial grade Tyvek or Henry or another one of the good house wraps around the exterior and then be able to tape to all of your opening and then put your siding over it. Take a look also perhaps at the cementous siding. That is something you can actually install yourself. It's relatively simple. You need special cutting blades, wear a respirator, eye protection. But take a look at Certainty Weatherboards. Take a look at the James Hardy Company. And you're going to have something that is even more resistant to hail than is steel siding.
There you go. Got an email from Joseph in Madison. He has a 1915 house with no insulation in the walls. It's 2x4 construction with plaster and lath on the inside walls and wooden claps covered by aluminum siding on the outside. I'm considering using blown-in cellulose or something similar to insulate the walls. Any major pitfalls to this regarding moisture buildup or damage to the plaster and or siding? Any concerns with plumbing or electrical in the walls?
Yes, many.
Yeah, a lot of problems there.
Go for it.
First, Joe, you're going to have to make sure that all your knob and tube wiring is out of those walls because if you get insulation around the knob and tube, it's going to melt, arc, and burn your house down. The plumbing in the walls isn't such an issue. I'd be surprised if you have much in the outside walls. The other thing to think about is vapor transfer, because what's going to happen is you do not have a vapor barrier on your 1915 house. It's probably balloon framed, which means the nails are really important for holding it all together. And if we get condensation on the backside of the sheathing, the nails are going to rust and your house is going to fall down. If this is a historic house that you were working on and had to follow the Department of Interior standards, they would tell you that you cannot insulate those walls until you put a vapor barrier on the interior of the house. Now, this can be done with vapor barrier paints, and HUD actually certifies several of those. So you're going to need to do a little bit of research. You can go to the Department of Interior and take a look at preservation briefs. I think that's it. It's preservation briefs, not restoration. Preservation briefs. Mm-hmm. And you can download some information from there to make sure that you do it right.
All right. Jim in Black River Falls, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I was wanting to put up one of these metal carports. I'd like to put like a foot of foundation lift on it. My plan was to bury some treated 6x6 and put a base plate on it and, treated plywood on the side down to the ground. How deep to bury them so you don't get a lot of movement to frost?
I think Black River Falls is still 4 foot, isn't it? If you can get them down 4 feet, you should be in pretty good shape.
I'd have to check the code book, but I think you're right. I think all over the state they consider 4 feet to be frost protection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the ends won't have anything across them, so I just wanted to make sure the sides would not move, underneath this.
Right, you don't want that to become a kite either.
right.
That's a real good point because you're going to have a lot of uplift on that, and mm-hmm. if it's in the ground, it's sort of like they're acting as pilings, and the friction mm-hmm. is going to help keep it from lifting up.
What some people do is they'll dig a hole 4 feet deep, they'll pour it full of concrete, and then they'll use a steel, an appropriate steel connector to connect the 4x4 or 6x6 at grade, and that has tremendous ability to hold the building down to the ground. So you might want to consider that too.
Pour the hole full?
Yeah, you could pour it full. You could pour it just below grade so that you don't see it. But it's nicer to have it up out of the ground because the steel is, unless you buy a stainless steel hanger, mm-hmm. it will rust over time. If it's out of the ground.
It allows you to do repairs and things. Yeah. And you can get what's called a round form called a sauna tube. You just cut it off with a plain old handsaw mm-hmm. to the length you want, put it in the ground. You hold it up so you have sort of an upside-down mushroom, so you've got a footing underneath. But you can pour it all at one time.
Yeah. So either that or just use a sauna tube and pour a concrete fill. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, just wondering how deep to go because, you know, there'll be no insulation and the inside will not have any snow for insulation. The outside will, so I didn't want them to move.
Yeah, if you're concerned about movement, get it onto the frost line, and that's 4 feet in your area.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Donna in Chippewa Falls painted her new garage floor with epoxy paint several years ago, but now it's chipping off. Wonders what she can do.
Epoxy paint. There's a lot of different qualities of epoxy paint. But one thing that I found is that salts from the road and the calcium,
potassium chloride, calcium chloride.
It's hard on epoxies unless you put a coat on top of it, and it'll pit and flake up off the concrete. There's a couple things that you can do. One is that you could apply another coat of epoxy, make sure it's a better, the best quality you can afford, but you have to prepare the floor properly, which is to etch everything so that you get a good mechanical bind between the old layer of epoxy and the new one. John, you've got some experience with epoxies, don't you? Because you're...
little bit.
My experience is about the same as yours, Ken. Yeah. One of the problems is if the floor has been in use for some time, you may already have salt and chemical deposition within the pores of the concrete, because concrete is porous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that stuff can start coming up over time.
That's a good point.
We'll ponder that a little bit more, and we will be back to talk some more with Ken Adams and John Freiberger right after we take a look at the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at home renovation and repair here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, my guest Ken Adams of Adams Design in Madison, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg, our two guests. Glad to have them in, and thank you for listening. Lots of callers online. I'll give you the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. Write it down because all the lines are filled right now, but we'll soon have one open right after we finish talking with Joyce and Nina. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I have a question about backsplashes and the grout and the caulk that goes in between the tile. Mm-hmm. It's a natural stone tile that was put in along my countertop, which holds my sink, and that's an outside wall. Then I also have it in two different areas in the kitchen that are inside walls. Because at first I thought it was cracking. The caulk was cracking off the tile and the countertop on that outside wall. I thought it had something to do with the weather because it got put in the summer, just this past summer. Mm-hmm. So the caulk was cracking off of the tile as well as the countertop, and then doing it on the other two areas too. So the guy who put it in came back, re-caulked it, and now it's doing it again. And then I was told you should really have grouted on the baseline. Grout and then caulk on that, and then it wouldn't crack. And then I was told, well, sometimes grout can, if you just put grout and no caulk, that would crack off your countertop. So I don't know what to do.
Well, what you're saying is you've got a stone backsplash, and what kind of a countertop do you have?
It's Formica.
Formica. So you've got two dissimilar materials on two different planes. The Formica sitting on top of a board, which is on top of your cabinets, and the stone is glued against the wall. So they're just naturally, they're going to expand and contract at different rates. Mm-hmm. So if you were to put a grout in between the Formica countertop and the backsplash, it's going to crack. It's going to crack, I guarantee, and it's going to do that seasonally.
Okay.
So I think appropriately they use a caulk in between the two surfaces that is elastic enough to be able to move with the seasons. Quite often people use relatively inexpensive acrylic caulks or water-based caulks that dry out very quickly. And as you clean them, you clean the countertops and that, they get brittle and then they crack within a couple of years. I'm guilty. My kitchen has exactly the same problem. And my wife has been getting on my case to re-caulk, but I just don't want to clean off the countertops to do it yet. So what you want to do is make sure you find the appropriate caulk to do it. And if it's a high elastic caulk that has some flexibility and has some adhesive qualities to it, that would be a very good starting point.
Well, how about putting grout on that baseline? Because it wasn't grouted.
As I'm saying, between the line at the seam between the countertop and the backsplash, you, because your countertop is going to expand and contract at different rates as your backsplash, grout, okay, because it's so rigid, is going to crack out. You could get a matching caulk. If you know where you got your tile, you might be able to get a matching caulk to your grout and grout it with that, and that should be, usually those are good enough quality to be, to have been made to be flexible for dissimilar dissimilar materials.
Okay.
Am I making sense? Are you?
Yeah.
Okay,
so,
great.
So a siliconized caulk, like 100% siliconized, a real elastic, or is it called, did you say, you called it something?
Well, there's several different types of caulks that you might be able to use.
Okay.
Some are siliconized, acrylics. I mean, John, what do you have luck with in kitchens?
Well, if this is really designed right, what you actually do is you actually keep the, you don't let the backsplash sit on top of the countertop. You actually put a piece of foam rod in there, and you leave like a 16th of an inch gap. And then you use a good siliconized butyl acrylic or whatever caulk.
Sure.
A caulk, basically, it's a control joint, just like we're putting in masonry on the exterior of a building.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just want a good stretchy caulk that, and this, the differential isn't much. Like Ken says, grout is so brittle that it breaks with any movement, but mm-hmm. any decent caulk is going to survive probably for 20 years.
There's some of these cheap water-based caulks that you can buy for like 89 cents a tube. That stuff usually gets brittle very quickly.
That's right. And you want a good quality caulk because you're going to be wiping the countertop. You don't want mold to develop in the caulk because then you've got to pull it out and redo it.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Dan in Fond du Lac, Carol and Dave in Wisconsin Rapids, first here. We have often heard a loud cracking sound in the night, which sounds like it's coming from our roof when it's below zero outdoors. There doesn't seem to be any damage to anything. We're wondering what makes this noise. Thanks for the great show. And we get that sound at our lake home, but that's ice usually.
Yeah, it's basically, it's simply thermal and moisture driven contraction of the wood, and it's making a loud banging sound.
Thing happens to my knees when I get out of bed in the morning.
And it never ends. My house was built in 1850s, and we heard it twice this morning. I said, "Is somebody goose hunting?" And my wife said, "No, that's the house again."
It's not really anything to worry about at this point, unless you see some problems developing. It's just really the house. The bones are aching. That's about it.
Yep, that's it. Well, my house has been doing it for 150 years, and your knees for about 100, and they're both still good.
Well, how about this from Dan in Fond du Lac? I have a 40-year-old Cape Cod. Would it be cost-effective to have proper vents installed in the attic above the outside vertical walls for additional insulation in that area?
In the attic.
To have proper vents installed in the attic above the outside vertical walls.
Yeah, I think I know what he means. What he's looking at is, because it's a Cape Cod, he's got these knee walls.
Mm-hmm.
And then his roof, the bottom side of the roof is a sloped ceiling.
Oh.
And yes, it's if you can possibly do it, if you can get proper vents up there, and then you can insulate the first floor ceiling behind the knee wall, insulate the knee wall very well, insulate the ceiling as best you can, and then you have continuous ventilation from the soffits all the way up to the ridge. It's a nice way of being able to do a Cape Cod.
But a lot of Cape Cods have no lower ventilation because there's no overhang.
That's correct.
So if he puts proper vents in and he doesn't put any sort of ventilation in the bottom, and there are things that can be done, but if he just puts the proper vents in, it's like wearing your coat in the middle of summer. It's not going to do anybody any good.
But what we've often done with those, Ken, is we've actually put a wall vent on either end of the attic space behind the knee wall, and we allow air to come in through that wall vent and up.
There you go.
But, study it out a little bit, Dave. Sometimes if you've got the space, you can actually add some Quikar, which is foam insulation with drywall bonded to it on those sloped ceilings. And you just nail it in place, finish it like drywall, and you're adding R9, R12, whatever you select, and you're going to lose a little bit of headroom, but you're going to pick up a whole bunch of insulation, because usually a Cape Cod is just a 2x4. By the time you put in that 1-inch proper vent, well, you've only got 2.5 inches of insulation, not much.
Yeah, not much. There we go. Let's go to Daniel in Milwaukee. Hi, Daniel.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have to plead ignorant. We've been thinking about installing a second bathroom above, right above the main floor bathroom. I don't even have a clue how you start this process. And part of that question is there like a website or something to go where they have like the best contractors or, I don't know if I said that question correct. But
yeah.
Well, here's a really good place to start, Daniel. If you are looking for someone that you can start working with as a contractor, look up the local NARI chapter. I know Milwaukee's got a very strong NARI chapter here.
It's N-A-H-R-I.
N-A-R-I. National Association of the Remodeling Industry.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. That's NAHB,
okay,
as you're thinking,
yeah.
Kitchens and baths. But if you start with NARI, I know almost all of the people that are NARI members here in the area, and almost without exception, I trust all of them. I think they're all very good quality people. And so, and I'm sure the same thing is true there. So
In Milwaukee.
I know the whole state has several good NARI chapters. So start there, find somebody that's got the ability to do some design work and so can help you create the design that you need to finish your bathroom, and you'll be in pretty good shape. Talk to a couple people before you settle in on one. Let them know what you're thinking about doing, and I'm sure things will work out well for you. Please give us a call and let us know how it went.
Yep, absolutely. N-A-R-I, NARI. National Association of the Remodeling Industry, right?
Yes.
All right. Let's go to Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, I think you have answered my question. I'm in my 80s. I have a 1952 Cape Cod with an 8-foot extension. I want to put in a bathroom without a tub on the second floor so somebody can be here to take care of me when I get older than the young I am.
Uh-huh.
And you just said NARI. Is that the way you would go? Is that kind of like a combination architect and plumber?
No. A NARI contractor is going to be good at designing within a space that already exists. Now, many Cape Cods, we find if we're going to put a second-floor bathroom on, because of the way they're laid out upstairs, which is sort of a long, sort of triangular tunnel, we need to put a dormer on. And when you get into a dormer on a Cape Cod, you really should be working with an architect
yeah.
Because there are significant issues, one of which we're fixing right now, where they put a dormer on a Cape Cod and now the roof looks like a pagoda. and so what you can do is simply go to the Wisconsin Society of Architects website. You'll be able to pick out an architect from there. You can find architects that work really quite inexpensively. They can do for you what are called builder's drawings. You know, they don't have to do all the interior design. You can have your NARI contractor do that. But you need to make sure that your structure is going to work, because if you have a Cape Cod, you have a house that where the biggest thing in it is a 2x4 in the roof structure, and you have to be very careful that you don't overload it. We see many, many, many houses where additions have been made and weight's been added to the second floor. And in fact, we've had two in the last month where the main beams on the house had significant structural issues. So we're getting into a little bit more complication than you want to trust simply to a contractor.
And that brings up another point for everybody. It really makes sense to pull permits for all the work that you do. Yeah, because the local building inspectors are going to review the work of your contractor.
No, I would never have anything done without a permit.
Good.
We've done that all these years.
And yeah. I've
lived here since 1954. I would never do anything without a permit. Anyhow.
Yeah. Fantastic.
There you go.
There I go. And
Jackie, you're going to be calling us 20 years from now. If
yeah,
we're still here, you'll probably still be having other issues that you're going to want to deal with. It's great to hear your voice every so often. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye-bye. John and Keener? Hi, John.
It would be Kellner.
Kellner. Oh, sorry.
Kellner. I have a 60s ranch style. It's on a concrete slab. Thinking about putting some type of flooring down, whether it be laminate or real wood. What do you recommend? It seems to be that the floor is more moist, you know, after rains. This is like
yeah.
You can feel the moisture on the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have an old-fashioned slab on grade. It does not have a water barrier underneath it the way your water impermeable barrier under it the way a new one has to have, and it also probably doesn't have a thermal break around the exterior. So you're probably going to want to treat that floor as if it were a basement floor. And if it were a basement floor, what you would be doing is you would be putting down a vapor retarder right over the concrete first. Then you'd be putting some insulation over it, not absolutely required, but I think you might be more comfortable at least with a half inch or three-quarter inch of like an isocyanurate insulation. And then over the top of that, put your sleepers and your subflooring. So you're going to lose 2 inches or so of headroom in there, but your floor is going to be a lot warmer. You're going to lock the vapor down at the concrete level, not let it come up underneath that floor, and it should give you a pretty good result.
Yeah, because I was just going to do is maybe get some of the laminate flooring with the sheets. I know you have to put the plastic sheets down first,
mm-hmm.
and then just lock it together. You don't think that would
Considering the two buildings we're working on in Madison right now that are brand new, where all the laminate flooring is coming up off the concrete, I think I would avoid that.
Really? Yeah. And subfloor, definitely a subfloor, though.
Yes, I think you definitely want a subfloor.
Now, this vapor retarder, is that something that you put on? Is it a liquid? Or?
No. Well, you can use a liquid, but that's expensive. All you need is 6 mil polyethylene sheeting, which you can pick it up at hardware or any lumber yard. You just want to make sure that it's lapped up at the edges and that you seal it as best you can. That is, if you have overlaps, you caulk the overlaps because you want to lock the moisture down in the concrete.
Makes sense.
Right. At that point, I could use regular, regular real wood.
Exactly. You can use anything you want because you've locked the vapor away, so you don't have to worry about decay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate it. And Jerry in Fox Point, we turn to you. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Yeah.
I've got sort of a question. Which way to go? I have a prairie-style ranch home that has 3 5x6 bay windows in a row. The one on the left is original from 1955, and it's lost its seal. My question is should I just plain replace the window, have them haul in a new one? And by doing my homework, I found out you can take the old window, get the seal replaced and it redone, and they bring you the old window back. Is that like overkill, or is there any merit either way?
Let me see if I understand this, Jerry. You've got several windows in the front of the house. Most of them have been replaced, but one of them is original?
Yes.
Is that correct?
It just lost its seal.
Okay.
Lost its seal, okay.
And are the new windows thermal paned windows and the original one just plain single pane?
No, they are all thermal panes.
They must be the screw-on type, or are they?
That I don't know, but they got like inch and a half quarter round on the outside of the window.
Hmm. Oh, good. So they're using that as stopping and remove them easily. Okay. Jerry, do you know about how thick these windows are from one side to the other, from the inside to the outside?
I would say an inch.
Oh, an inch. Okay, so they're pretty good size then.
So he's got a 7/8
gap. Yeah, they're pretty thick glass.
Yeah. Well, yes, indeed. You can take that in since it is a nice wide glass and you've got a decent R rating and you can have the air evacuated and the seals redone. But the problem is what you can't get is you can't get the suspended heat films in them. And the suspended heat films are going to pick up more R value for them. So I think what you should probably do is price both of them. Milwaukee Glass is probably a good company to talk to down there. Or talk to a NARA contractor who does a bit of this.
Okay.
Now you say you have a prairie style ranch house. Do you know who the architect?
There's a 42 inch overhang over all those windows.
Do you know who the architect it was on the house? Well, whether you know it or not, let me just give you one other suggestion here.
Yeah.
There is possibility, if it was an architect who's fairly well known, that your house might qualify to be registered under Wisconsin Historic Places. And then things like the repair of this glass, you would get a 25% state tax credit for doing it. And you can go to State Historic Society Wisconsin website. Click on homeowner tax credits and see if maybe your house is historic and that any work that you do on it, you may be able to get tax credits.
Yeah,
so
take
a look at it. It sounds like you've got a house that may have a little exceptionality to it.
Okay, I have all the old architectural drawings and prints. The owners left them with the house.
Wonderful.
That's wonderful.
Okay, now just a side question. That woman that called in about caulk on the backsplash?
Yeah.
Okay, I come from industrial repair and development mechanic background, and we used a lot of what's called RTV sealant, room temperature vulcanizing.
Mm-hmm.
A tube of that cost about $6 to $8, but I've had that around my shower spigot and faucet for the last, 13 years, and it's still soft and can be.
They have a high
compound.
They have a high adhesive quality too, don't they? For RTV,
yeah.
RTVs.
And I've even used it around my when I replaced my electric to a gas cooktop around the top of the cooktop there because it's rated up to 400 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
But the best thing is the downside is when you do use it, you have to make sure the joint is super clean, otherwise it don't stick.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you very much.
And I get that at Granger because nobody else carries it.
There you go.
Thanks, Jerry.
Yeah. Got a lot of good information, so I've been listening here for the last hour in the car. So, hey, great.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for calling. You know, we've been talking about NARI, and Charles from emailed and said, don't forget the NARI Home Improvement Show is at State Fair Park in West Allis at the Expo Building on February 10th, today through the 13th.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm.
So
we just had ours in Madison last week.
Yes, there are NARI shows all over the state in different localities, which is nice because then you've got the local contractors showing up.
Yep, absolutely. What Don in Door County is wondering if you could explain the Wisconsin law covering the word design being used in home construction advertising. I've encountered unscrupulous businesses using the word design inappropriately.
Well, design can mean anything to anybody.
Yeah, there's not a legal definition.
Well, there may be, but in the state of Wisconsin, there's interior designers, there's bath designers, there's kitchen designers, there's architects. Then it goes on and on. What you're looking for when you're looking for somebody that will do some quote design work for you, if it's non-structural, if it's something like putting a bathroom in or putting a kitchen in, you want somebody that has some accreditation with either NARI or NAHB. Some other NAHB is the National Association of Home Builders. National Kitchen and Bath Association. If it's structural, you want somebody that has either an engineering background or is an architect or both. And there are a lot of people out there that call themselves designers and don't have the ability to do structural analysis and get themselves into trouble. And John and I fix a lot of these projects over the years. However, there are a lot of people that are out there that do have some structural design backgrounds and can be very, very positive. So I wouldn't shy away from the word designer. And I wouldn't just say because he's an architect, he's the guy for me, because there are architects that concentrate on plumbing fixtures for boats, and you might not want them in your, you know, working on your house. But and I'm saying that in, you know, sort of hyperbole, but I think that if you really do your research on the people, talk to the people that have worked for in the past, check with the local associations, you'll be in good shape.
Guys, thank you so much for being with us today. You'll be back in a couple months, and we'll do this all over again.
We will.
Thank you.
And, John, your email is?
FREI@chorus.net. Chorus like a group of singers.
Okay. And, Ken, your website is?
Our website is adamsofmadison.com.
adamsofmadison.com. Thanks.
All right.
And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.